Ladies and gentlemen, live from the West Coast, it's time for Ring Talk Live Worldwide. Your inside look into combat sports. And now, the host of the longest-running fight show in radio and internet history.
But he has a shock in store for him. He has two great chances, Slim and none, and Slim's out of town.
Pedro Fernandez.
I wanted to do the right thing.
Damas y caballeros, bienvenidos, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Sports Byline Broadcast Network and hour number two of Ring Talk Live Worldwide. Of course, to the Sunday edition, we come to you initially at 11 a.m. Pacific on for 2 hours live on Sports Byline, iHeartRadio, Sirius XM, Satellite Radio, Channel 217, like 1,000 other internet platforms. Straight up, this hour of Ring Talk Live Worldwide, I will concentrate. I will spend a segment talking about squares and boxing, white-collar boxing. Of course, guys get hurt doing this. Guys get off doing this. What am I going to talk about? Will I be a little hypocritical? I probably will be. Bottom line is, we'll talk about that in depth at about 20, 23 minutes past the hour. We have open phone lines around the planet. If you want to drop in, you can. 1-800-878-7529. That's 1-800-878-7529. We'll be talking about some of the quotes of the great Muhammad Ali. Of course, here's one. Wars of nations are fought to change maps, but wars on poverty are fought to map changes. Muhammad Ali, 1975. So we'll talk about some of the writings of Muhammad Ali. We'll go into depth on robberies and, of course, white-collar boxing, and as well as, of course, the world of the UFC. We'll touch on that just to an extent in this hour or more, just to a small extent. Of course, boxing is the subject. Of course, boxing, rock and roll last night in Las Vegas, a bit of a one-punch knockout there in the sixth round. Of course, I'm talking about, man, what can I say? When Richard Comey comes to fight, all I can say is, don't be on the other end of the punches unless you're like Teofimo Lopez. It took the undisputed world lightweight champion to beat that guy. I mean, that guy's just a monster, no doubt about it. And what he did to Mr. Morenas last night was just sad in the sixth round. Of course, Morenas, a robbery victim last August. Instead of getting a championship and defending a championship last night, he came in and got his head handed to him for a lousy 25 grand. That's boxing. You are tuned to Ring Talk Live Worldwide. Check it. Your inside look into the world of boxing and MMA.
You ask me how well that he fights, I don't know, but I can tell you one thing, he punched good.
Let little Eva do her thing here.
Everybody's doing a brand new dance now. Come on, baby.
The Locomotion. Man, is that the boxing world in a nutshell or what? The Locomotion. Holy cow. Locomotion. Straight up, you are tuned to Ring Talk Live Worldwide. Your inside look at the world of boxing, MMA, of course. In this hour, a little later, I'll get into Joe Frazier in depth. You heard Joe just a little bit there, of course, talking about how George Foreman hit him hard. No doubt about that. But in that first fight, I thought George was a little bit dirty. George was a dirty fighter. I watched him in the gym. He would fight guys who were my size. Nah, I take that back. A little bigger than me. I'm weighing like 160 now. I used to fight guys like 170, 175 pounds. And he would weigh like 220, 225, okay? And he'd bounce these guys all over the ring, lift them up off the ground with uppercuts like he did Joe Frazier. I kid you not, okay? He was just a bully. Of course, the guy that sold burgers and became, golly gee whiz, everybody's Uncle George. You know, he was a creep. He was a stone cold creep here in San Francisco. Of course, he came to us from Newark, California, which is across the bay, down there, Fremont, California. You go across the San Mateo Bridge. The bottom line is he was in the Job Corps over there. Of course, he came to us from the 54th Ward originally in Houston, Texas, which is a hellhole. And that's just the best way I could put it. It's a hellhole. I don't know anybody. When I went down to Houston, I stayed away from the wards. This is the way it is. You stay away from the wards. Anyway, George Foreman gets into the Job Corps because they think he's going to go to prison instead if he keeps beating people up down there in, on the streets and like down in Houston. So they sent him to the Job Corps and here in Newark, California. He starts chopping wood and get disciplined, and then they sort of like introduce him to boxing. You want to learn how to box? Yeah, okay, okay. And of course, it was cool for George because George was bigger than everybody, and when you're bigger than everybody, it means you could basically beat up on everybody because George, as I said, was a bully, and he could punch, and he could throw hands. I mean, there's no doubt about it. He's a big dude, a brute, you know. So George would lump up on people here in the gym, and of course, I used to watch it. My father used to tell me he was a bully. My father would tell me that. I said, Dad, what do you mean? He goes, see that guy right there? He goes, yeah, He goes, he's going to be in the Olympics next year, I think. I said, yeah, really? That was like 1967. I said, really, Dad? He goes, yeah. He goes, but he's a bully. He's a bully. Look, he's always beating up on little guys. He's a bully. Anyway, of course, George Foreman will go on to win the heavyweight championship in 1973. Of course, taking out Joe Frazier and losing it in 1974 to Muhammad Ali and then regaining it like, you know, almost 20 years later against Michael Moore. Of course, Michael Moore is famous for one thing, being knocked out by an old man. Ooh. But I did one of Foreman's fights. I think I did a George Foreman, J.B. Williamson fight for FNN Sports. That was in May of 1989 down in Galveston, Texas. And I talked to George about the old days, about the golden gloves and how the, you know, he was a bully. And I talked to him about that. I said, George, I used to watch you when I was a kid. I said, you know, and you would beat up on guys who were like smaller than me. I don't want to say smaller than me, but small, little, tiny guys. And he would look at me and he said, that's one of the bad parts of boxing. He said, you know, when I learned how to box, he goes, it was beat on people. That's why there was no learning. He goes, I didn't learn anything about boxing until Muhammad Ali taught me what boxing was all about when he put that dope on the rope. Of course, the dope was me. Anyway, he said, I knew nothing about boxing. I mean, boxing to me was just all physical before then. It became mental at that point in time. Okay. Bottom line is, George was a good spokesperson. I mean, he did the Wendy's burgers and all that kind of good stuff. But I'll never give up. I'll never forgive George for what he did today, German Shepherd. Did I tell you that one? Yeah. Get this. They're at a hotel. They're in like a 14th floor of a hotel. And George is on the balcony with his dog and he's there with his former manager. And, anyway, George gets his dog up on a table and he says, I bet you I can get this dog to jump off the balcony. Onto its death. I mean, it's 14 stories below. This is how sick George Foreman is, okay? So the guy says, nah, you ain't gonna do that. And he goes, yeah, I am. Watch. You put him up there. Dog jumped off the balcony, 14 stories to his death. That's George Foreman. The guy that was beating up on those guys in the gym. They say, you know, he had a conversion. He met God and all this kind of good stuff. I don't know. I don't know if you can ever, you know, wipe away that type of evilness. He was evil. He just was. I watched him beat up on people, as I said, who were smaller than him, and that dog thing. What can I say? So when I see George, I say hello, and you know, he knows that we go back to Newman's Gym and that kind of good stuff, so we're down with that, but he also knows, man, that I knew he was a creep. I mean, George Foreman was when I was growing up, he was a creep. I mean, he was scared, everybody was scared to death of him, as well you should be. He was a brute with a pair of boxing gloves, no doubt about that. Of course, beating, the Russian and the Cuban for the 68 Olympic gold medal down there in Mexico City. Of course, at the same time, those other three black athletes were protesting. Of course, George just wove the flag. I'll lead you with. I'll do anything you want for me. He was here. He was, you know, company type of guy for a while. Then he got the title. Then things changed. I remember we went down to, Caracas, Venezuela to take on Kenny Foreman. I think that was right before the Ali fight in, Zaire, Africa. He went down to fight Kenny Foreman, knocked out Foreman like in one round. And I'll never forget Jack Fisk, of course, my mentor, the writer extraordinaire, the Hall of Fame writer for the San Francisco Chronicle, the man that I named my daughter after, Jacqueline. You know, he went down there, and I remember him telling me after the fights that he had never seen anything like George Foreman in his entire life, and he would have bet his house. If he was a betting man, Mr. Finkelstein would have bet his house, everything he owned in the bank, everything he had in the bank, everything he owned on George Foreman to beat Muhammad Ali. Well, if you listen to Jack Fisk make boxing predictions, you went broke. Because although Jack was the greatest writer in all of boxing, and he was my mentor, and I called him the godfather of boxing writers, all that kind of good stuff, a Hall of Famer, 37 years or 35 years with the SF Chronicle before I got him that gig with Flash Magazine. I mean, he was the greatest writer of all time, but he was the worst predictor of all time. In fact, I know guys that went, that would see Jack's picks in the paper, they would go the opposite way, and they make money. I kid you not. Last night, I want to mention this. Unbeaten junior middleweight champion. I picked it by unbeaten junior middleweight. Brian Castano, 17 and zip with a draw and 12 KOs. Dethroned WBO 154-pound champion Patrick Tuzera last night. Tuzera coming in 31-1, left 31-2, 22 KOs. 12-round unanimous nod down there at Fantasy Springs Casino in Indio, California. That was a place where my bottle melted. My water bottle melted. I was sitting ringside. I think we were doing an Alexander Zolkin fight down there on TV and radio. We're doing both. And I put it like a water bottle on next to me, and it melted. It melted. So that's how hot it was. I think it was like 120 degrees ringside. Shane Mosley was there that night, but Alexander Zolkin came up short. And the reason why I'm bringing up Zolkin is that his coach was John Johnson. John Johnson, former Ohio State football coach under Woody Hayes, and of course the manager, the man that guided Buster Douglas to the upset of Mike Tyson, the meltdown of Mike Tyson in 1990. Of course, Iron Mike Tyson getting melted down. Woo, aluminum Mike turned into aluminum Mike that day with Buster Douglas. But he was the guy that got Buster Douglas in shape for that fight, mentally and physically. Of course, John Johnson tested positive. He had some lung cancer issues about a year and a half ago. And we were like talking all the time, and he was telling me he was in recovery and, you know, this kind of stuff. And he came on the radio show a couple times and talked about how good it was to recover from, you know, lung cancer and the fact that you don't need to smoke, all that kind of good stuff. Anyway, he went on and on. He took himself off Facebook, and I can't get him. His phone's disconnected. So when somebody with cancer has their phone disconnected and they pull off Facebook and there's no social media contacts for them and you can't get a hold of them, you start to get scared. So anybody out there that knows John Johnson, of course, Coach John Johnson, Ohio State, formerly Ohio State boxing, Ohio State football and boxing in Columbus, Ohio, could you please get the coach to give me a call or send me a text or something like that, because I am extremely worried about him. Back to that WBO 154-pound title fight last night. This is how impressive Castano was and dominant. The scores, 120-108, 12 zipping rounds, 119-109, that means, you know, 11-1 in rounds. And straight up, 117-111 means 8-3-1 in rounds. Straight up, fantastic win for Brian Castano. We'll see what he can do at 154. As far as 160 pounds concerned, we talked about the head case that is Jermell Charlo. Of course, the WBC champion, undefeated in 30 fights. He's been a pro since 2008. Still doesn't have a significant fight on his entire ledger. He just doesn't have it. His resume is like a bunch of guys that he should beat. Okay. I can't fault him for that, but you know, he wants to step up and fight Canelo Alvarez for the big bucks. He was talking about making Canelo the god of boxing right now. Of course, the king of pay-per-view. He wanted Canelo to come back to 160 to fight him. Are you out of your mind? Anyway. He now has been approached with a fight to take on David Benavidez, a former WBC super middleweight champion. Comes to us, I think, from Phoenix or somewhere in Phoenix or Fresno, where he hangs out in both cities. Anyway, bottom line is, kid's undefeated. Got a cocaine issue. You know, he had that coke problem. So, of course, he was rocking and rolling. He had the title and this and that. I think he lost the title on the scale. And, you know, when you look at this kid, he's a fantastic looking fighter. Got the right attitude, you know, a little ghetto. Got to have a little street in him. If you don't have street in a boxer, you're probably not going to have a good boxer. I mean, boxers don't come from college. I mean, we'll talk about that in the next segment. But boxers for the most part, with the exception of James Bone Crusher Smith, he's the only heavyweight champion I know of that had a college degree. Not saying it was like from Harvard or anything like that, but he's the only guy I know that ever had a Harvard college degree being a heavyweight champion. So I can't say that guys in boxing are not that academically gifted. We'll talk about that as we change. Of course, white-collar boxing after the break. Why don't I want to talk about white-collar boxing? Well, somebody brought it up to me. The fact that they've got a young man in the household. He's 28, 30 years old. He wants to start boxing, maybe having a couple of fights and this kind of stuff. And, you know, the person mentioned professional and this and that. I went, yikes, they're professional. Anyway, we'll get to that in depth after the break. You are tuned to Ring Talk Live Worldwide. Check it. Your inside look into the world of boxing, MMA. Missing Mary Wilson, baby. What can I say? Missing Mary. You are tuned to the Insider's Look into the World of Boxing. Ring Talk Live Worldwide. That sort of caught me off guard there. Mary Wilson, you're tuned to Ring Talk.
Now, more of Ring Talk with Pedro Fernandez.
Well, you have to talk to my lawyer on that one.
White-collar boxing, according to Wikipedia, started at Gleason's Gym in New York City. Actually, started in a lot of gyms across the country. They just didn't call it white-collar boxing. Gleason's got the rap because of the fact they had these guys that would box each other like once or twice a month. You know, they like a stockbroker would fight another insurance guy and that kind of good stuff. So we'll get to that in just a second, squares and boxing. You know, I want to talk about the deaths that I've witnessed in the ring. And the reason why I'm bringing it up because this will lead into that. Anyway, the first time I witnessed anything that I thought was really going to go crazy was I was in San Jose, California, I think in 1988 or 1989. And Rico Velasquez Jr., who had a broken nose going into the fight, he was a California lightweight champion, he was taking on David Gonzalez. Gonzalez was like a ranked contender at the time, and he was a monster. In other words, Gonzalez was going to destroy this guy. There was just absolutely no doubt about it. I was the only one that went up to his dressing room before the fight and interviewed Rico, so I was the last one to interview him before he would die. The fight started in the midst of 10 rounds. He died in the 10th round, but in the midst of 10 rounds, he was knocked down four or five times, of which the referee, Henry Hank Alesbrew of Sacramento, California, he missed two or three knockdowns. I mean, that's how bad the refereeing was. And of course, Hank was a bit of a guy. He was a bit of a drunk. I mean, I accused him and I put it in paper. I said that being a former police officer, I said he entered a ring in Sacramento, California to officiate a fight smelling with the reeking of an alcoholic beverage. I said that I could smell the aroma of an alcoholic beverage on his breath, that his eyes were bloodshot, that his speech was a little bit off, the whole nine yards. In other words, I was describing a drunk to you, okay? But Clyde Gray was the athletic commission director at the time, and guess what? Clyde Gray was a drunk too, so that didn't go anywhere, okay? So many years later, 1988 or 89, here's Alesbrew, refereeing this state title fight down there in San Jose, California, Civic Auditorium. So, as I said, Rico's getting his head handed to him. And after the ninth round, I got up out of my chair and because I'm watching Rico Velasquez's father, who was Rico Sr., and he's telling him, in Spanish, I don't know, show me some balls. Please show me your balls. That's what he's telling this kid. This kid's been knocked down like eight times. I'm not kidding you. Seven or eight times, four official at least, okay? Eight times. I mean, he's behind on the scorecards. This fight should have been stopped, and it just wasn't. So, Alesbrew, I'm begging with him. I go, Hank, you gotta stop this fight. You gotta stop this fight, Hank. I go, he's gonna get killed. Hank, please stop this fight. He grabs his towel. He looks at me. He wipes the sweat off his brow. He said to me, son, go take your seat and let me do my job. Go back to your seat. I said, he's going to get killed. At the same time, the aforementioned Jack Fist of the SF Chronicle grabs me by the seat of my pants and says, you can't tell a referee that. And I turned around and said, you don't know boxing. This guy's about to die. Okay, 40 seconds later, Rico Velasquez was dead. Okay, we went to the hospital afterwards, and I remember Jack Fist telling me on the way home, he was almost in tears. He said, I'll never tell you when to speak up ever again. I'll never tell you when to speak up again. Because he knew I was right. The kid died. Okay? So then a few months later, this is 89, I guess it was 1990, I'm in Las Vegas, and I'm ringside doing some fights for, I think called the BAM promotions at the time. I was their TV guy, this kind of stuff. So we're doing these televised fights ringside, and I take that back. This was an off TV fight. Johnny Montanez came to Las Vegas. Of course, he wanted to, you know, fulfill his dream, become a contender. Anyway, he ended up losing his life for lousy $2,000 a night. He got $2,000 for the night. Of course, 28-year-old journeyman boxer. He died just a few days after, of course, a fight with James Creighton. Creighton couldn't lick a stamp if he wet his tongue. Creighton couldn't punch. He couldn't punch, but don't you get it? Johnny was damaged going in. And people don't want to take that into consideration. I mean, you can look at guys. You can see certain guys. There are certain people that shouldn't box. Another boxing death that took place here in San Francisco out there at the Third Street Gym, on Third Street here on the Bayview. Hector Martinez told me, he said, you know, some of these guys, Hector being the former two-time Golden Glove champion and a co-manager of Roberto Duran, he told me, he said, you know, some of these people shouldn't be boxing, Pete. Yeah, really? He goes, yeah, I mean, and he was telling me that before. He goes, you know, they got these white collar guys, you know, these squares. He called them other names. Anyway, we've got these guys boxing each other out there on Third Street. He goes, and I think somebody's going to get hurt. So why do you say that, bro? He goes, because these guys can't fight, bro. He goes, when you can't fight, things happen. You can't, in other words, you're not a race car driver because you got a car and a helmet. And you're not a boxer because you got a pair of gloves and a headgear and a mouthpiece. I mean, you've got to be, how can I put this, ingrained into the boxing trade or the world of boxing, this and that. And I just don't think it happens right away. I mean, I can't think of anybody that came on late in life, like some of these white, I can't hear of any, think of any white collar boxers went on to win championships or anything like that. Okay. I mean, if they fight each other, it's sort of okay. I can deal with that. You know, some white guy from, you know, Oakland or fighting a guy from Berkeley, you know, they're like both 28 or 30 years old. Yeah, I can sort of go with that. But you've also got to have a competent corner. And that's really important. I mean, when I was in working corners for the Mission Boxing Club, of course, I had my little boxing club there in the Mission in the 80s, I had a towel with me all the time. And people used to say to me, why does he always got a towel for himself? Does he think he's a wetback or something? I go, why does he always got a towel? The reason why I always had a towel was I was ready to throw that towel in the ring and stop the fight at any given moment. Because you know what? A referee is not perfect. He's not infallible. In fact, they're human. They make mistakes. I'm not going to allow them to make a mistake with one of my kids in the ring. It's just not going to happen. You know where I'm coming from? I mean, I see my kids with their eyes crossed. I'm throwing the towel in the ring. The referee maybe can't see it, but I'm watching them closer than the referee is, okay? And if I see something that's wrong, I throw the towel in. So I was quick. I was like the Jerry Tarkanian of amateur boxing. I would throw the towel in a minute. I remember Carlos Lobo was getting drilled out the Cal Palace, and he said to me, this is what he told me, let me go out on my back. My parents are here. I want to get knocked. That's what do you mean you want to get knocked? He goes, if I can't win, I want to go out fighting to the death. What are you, nuts? Anyway, I threw the towel in on him. Of course, he may have been suicidal because he died on a motorcycle accident, about 2 or 3 months later. And it was, you know, one car type of thing with a bike, but passing cars in traffic in the Mission District. But some people, they can deal with boxing. They sort of adapt to it, you know, and some people don't. I mean, as I said, Hector's talked about the guy out there on Thursday, guy ended up dying. I mean, guy's like a 30-year-old guy, never had any fights, ended up dying, okay? And then, you know, you've got people that are pros, and then you put guys in situations where they shouldn't be. I mean, I'm talking about, this is pretty tough. Roy King Jr., he died Tuesday in the New York City healthcare facility. In other words, like, a home for disabled people that are screwed up. He was only 42 years old. But get this, he was one of those latecomers in the world of boxing, okay? Latecomer in the world of boxing, meaning he didn't put on any gloves till he was 32 years old. And, you know, I mean, he didn't have much of an amateur career, and he went 12-4 or 12-5 as a professional with one draw, not a big puncher, this and that. He was always the opponent. In fact, when he upset, Chris Thomas in October 2019, a unanimous nod over him from some regional rinky-dink WBC United States silver title. Anyway, he was the opponent there. He was brought in to lose. Unfortunately, Chris Thomas couldn't lick a stamp, so he lost. Anyway, bottom line is King would fight once after that. Okay? And he would get knocked down 4 times in a fight, an 8-round fight. In other words, if a guy gets knocked, here's what's up. Let me run this one down to you. We're talking mathematics, okay? Let's talk mathematics just for a second in boxing. Right? There's 8 rounds in a boxing match. You get knocked down 3 times, you're down 6 points. 6 points. Okay? You're not gonna win this fight. You're not a puncher. There's no reason why these fights, listen, some of these fights, especially in the UFC, don't get me going there, but some of these fights you get them going, 4 or 5 rounds are done, guy's getting his head handed to him. He's totally being dominated. I mean, you're waiting on a knockout. Why are you waiting for this man to be abused and possibly hurt when you know it's over with? Listen, when the competition ends, the fight should end. Okay? And when guys get hurt, fight should be stopped. This guy got knocked down 4 times January 16th in Nashville, Tennessee at the fairgrounds. Got knocked down 4 times, okay, in an 8-round fight. So, I mean, they wanted him to finish the fight on his feet so he could feel proud? He ended up dying 13 months later. Why? Guy picked up the gloves at the age of 32 years old. At 42, he sure shouldn't have been fighting guys that could fight. I mean, he shouldn't have been fighting anybody even could spell the word fight. But he did, and Roy King Jr. died at the age of 42. Another guy picked up the gloves at the age of 32. Now, I'm not trying to say that everybody that picks up gloves at the age of 32 or late in life gets hurt. What I'm trying to say is there's a greater propensity of people getting hurt if they pick up boxing later in life than they pick up earlier in life. In other words, when I had those early fights at the Boys Club in San Francisco, I don't call them fights, they were smokers, 1-minute rounds, there wasn't a whole lot of skill to it. You blow through guys, you go out there and you throw punches for 60 seconds, and you guess what? You're going to beat the other guy. Okay? Then we went to 2 minutes, and I sort of lost my first fight, so I looked like a stamp, sort of figured out what that was all about. But I realized, in 1984, I fought in the National Golden Glove Championships in Las Vegas. I never, ever realized how dangerous boxing was until I fought Ernie Chavez. And I tell you why. We were fighting at 147. He said he weighed 168 that day because he weighed in 3 or 4 days earlier. Anyway, the bottom line is he was a southpaw. He could punch and this and that. And I never, ever thought about getting hurt in boxing until he hit me. When I got up, there was 8 Ernie Chavez across the ring. Okay? I was smart enough to stop the fight myself. The corner, from the National Golden Glove people, they were working my corner. They didn't stop it. They should have stopped it. Bottom line is, I was smart enough to save my own life. Most boxers aren't. You got to have a good trainer. You're tuned to Ring Talk Live Worldwide.
Oh,
Now, more of Ring Talk with Pedro Fernandez.
Down to the nightclub. We haven't been to a nightclub since February. Last year, you are tuned to Ring Talk Live Worldwide. And who knows, with this COVID thing, we might not get out for another year. Hopefully, it will happen in late 2021 or 2022. Of course, the Godfather Larry Merchant's got his vaccine. I can't wait to get mine. I mean, everybody's like saying, I don't want to get it first. Listen, I took the measles vaccine. I took the polio vaccine. I didn't have any problems with those vaccines. I mean, why all of a sudden are we starting to question science? What are you guys, idiots? You're questioning science? And you're going to take religion over science to some extent? Come on, man. That's a bit of a reach. Anyway, switching back to the subject hand. Of course, I promised you last week a one-hour special on Joe Frazier. Well, the person that was supposed to put that show together with me sort of flaked out on that. Of course, we're going to do it next week. We'll get into depth on Joe Frazier next week. But coming up on 50 years, March 8th, 1971, two gold medalists, 1960, light heavyweight gold medalist Cassius Clay, later to become Muhammad Ali. 1964, Olympic gold medalist Smoking Joe Frazier. Of course, Ali won his title in Rome. Joe Frazier won his title in Tokyo. When they hooked up in 1971, Muhammad Ali had been off basically for 3.5 years. He had two comeback fights, one against Jerry Corey, which lasted about 3 rounds. Then he had a 14-round fight, or I think it was 14 rounds, with Oscar Bonavena stopping the Argentine late in the fight. So he had these two fights. He wasn't really in good shape yet. He knew he wasn't sharp yet. He wasn't ready yet. But Joe Frazier's people, Yank Durham, said, if you don't take the fair fight with Frazier now, we're going to make you wait 2 years before you get a title shot. Well, Ali didn't want to wait 2 years, and Herbert Muhammad and those guys wanted that money. It was Ali's manager, so they ended up having the fight March 8th, 1971. Anyway, Muhammad Ali is 31-0. Joe Frazier is 26-0. Of course, Joe Frazier will win a 15-round decision and probably, I don't know, I looked out the window of my house when I was living on Godius, like it was an alley between Coleridge and Mission Street here in San Francisco, out in the middle of the Mission. And I looked out my window during the fight, and there wasn't any cars on the street. There wasn't any buses going. I was listening on the radio. There were no buses going by. The entire world had come to a stop. A complete stop, I kid you not, for these two men, Smoking Joe Frazier and Muhammad Ali. We'll celebrate their 50-year anniversary. Of course, it'll be next week, and I hope to bring in Richard and possibly Marvis Frazier as well. Now, we go back in time. This is your life, Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier.
Not many people have gone the full 15 rounds with you, but before we close, I'd like to remind you of someone who has. Just as he promised he would one August day in 1970, during your exile from the ring, when he gave you a lift in a car from Philadelphia to New York, and when he pulls up on 42nd Street, a crowd starts to gather.
And I said, hey, man, you better get out of my car.
Not Joe
Frazier. People might think you and I are good pals.
You've described him as the fighter you most admire, your old adversary. We've flown him from Philadelphia.
Not Joe Frazier.
Smoking Joey. Joe, how did you come to be giving Muhammad Ali a lift in your car?
Well, number one, I had a chance to move around in Philadelphia, and I went to one of the hotels, and I promised to give him a ride to New York City that day. I got out of the car. Somebody says, hey, go Smoking Joe Frazier. Oh, man, and he went off. Smoking Joe Frazier? Where is he? I want Smoking Joe Frazier. He got my title. So I went over and I shook his hand.
Crazy.
He told me, he said, listen, sir, I have a man who's doing a book on me. Would you interview him into New York City? We rode into New York City. This guy would not let me get one word in. All through the whole ride, he started talking about Smoking Joe Frazier. Can you whip me? Can you whip me? So Joe, Smoking Joe Frazier. See, I wrote a poem. He said, Joe, come out smoking. I'll be poking, pouring water on that smoking. He said, I might amaze you. I will be tired smoking Joe Frazier. All through the whole time in New York, from Philadelphia to New York City, I had to go through that noise all the way.
What did you do?
So I had a chance to, we got into New York City, 42nd.
He slapped me.
42nd is Broadway, and somebody messed around and saw him and myself, and he went off again. Smoking Joe Frazier, ladies and gentlemen, Smoking Joe Frazier, the man who got my title, I won my title. I was in the car.
Oh, Lord.
I said, look, I'll whoop this sucker right now.
So after a while, he got back in the car and kind of cooled down some. I said, hey, man, cool it off. You know what I mean? So he said, a song. Start singing. It's not singing. Ladies and gentlemen, a great guy. I would say we love him. He's a fine champion.
Oh,
thank you.
I'll say one thing. I might see how you got the other people. How did you get Joe Frazier here? My man, Joe Frazier.
I want you to listen to this, Muhammad. As a boy, you worship one particular... I am, just about. But I want to remind you of one particular boxing hero who later in life, you've got to know, and who sadly cannot be here because, as you know, he recently underwent massive heart surgery, which has affected his powers of speech. But such is his high regard for you that here... in his home in Leicester.
Joe Frazier. Joe Frazier. Yeah.
Joe, how did you come to be giving Muhammad Ali a lift in your car?
Well, number one, I had a chance to move around in Philadelphia, and I went to one of the hotels, and I promised to give him a ride to New York City that day. I got out the car. Somebody says, "Hey, go Smoking Joe Frazier." Oh, man, and he went off. Smoking Joe Frazier. Where is he? I want Smoking Joe Frazier. He got my title.
Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier, This Is Your Life, no doubt about that. Of course, that was in 1977 over in the UK. And, of course, Joe Frazier and Muhammad Ali. You know, when I interviewed Joe, I spent some time around Joe. Joe said Joe drank a lot. That was my problem with Joe, is that I never knew how to approach Joe Frazier. I mean, it was like he was like almost a manic type of guy. In other words, he was either in a great mood or you didn't want to get nowhere near him. I mean, nowhere around him. And maybe I misunderstood him, okay? Because I heard stories about him taking a gun in the gym he ran in Philadelphia, Joe Frazier's gym, and he cleared out the gym one day. In other words, you know, if you were boxing with your gloves on in the gym, in the ring, you left right there with your boxing gloves on and walked out. You didn't get your clothes out of the locker. You didn't do that stuff. Joe got upset and ran everybody out of the gym with a gun. Okay, so Joe drank a bit, of course, and I said, you know, he was an alcoholic. But so when I would see him, I never knew how to approach him. You know, I mean, I didn't know whether to smile. I didn't know whether to say hello. I sort of like wanted him to let him go first sometimes, you know, and hey, what's up, Joe? You know, that kind of stuff. But I remember in Atlanta, we were at the Omni. We were doing a Vaughn Bean, Evander Holyfield heavyweight title fight. I was working for Don King Productions doing the television there. I was the interview guy. I think I was scoring the fight too, but I was the interview guy. I remember interviewing wrestler Bill Goldberg that night. But they sent me into Von Bean's dressing room. Von Bean was ranked number one at the point in time. I don't know why he was ever ranked number one. He was never a top contender, but he got three title shots being ranked number one. That was Butch Lewis, his promoter. And of course, he was in the locker room with Joe Frazier. It was Joe Frazier, Butch Lewis, and the fighter, okay? And they were looking at each other and they were talking, and I smelled, like, as soon as I walked in the room, I smelled this, like, booze. I mean, like, wow. I mean, that, like, alcohol hitting you, bah, boom, like a left hook hitting you in the face. Holy cow. Who's drinking? Well, it turned out Joe was drinking. Joe was drinking and Butch was drinking. Of course, they went out there and they worked the corner for Vaughn Bean, and throughout the 12-round fight, it went 12-round decision, Evander Holyfield winning, but all throughout the 12-round fight, they kept calling the referee, who was a Caucasian man, Brian Gary out of Florida, my buddy, went to China with me twice. They were calling him a honky and a square and all kinds of stuff like that. And, you know, he was in the position where he could have thrown them out of the arena. And I talked to him about it later. I said, you know, why did you let those people call you? They call you square. They were saying stuff. Joe and Butch were saying stuff that I can't repeat on the air. You know, there's words you can't say on the radio, like on TV. Yeah, still, FCC rules. Anyway, I couldn't repeat that stuff. And I'm watching Joe and Butch assail the referee. So the referee tells me later, he says, you know, I was in a bad spot there. I go, yeah, bad spot. He goes, I couldn't throw Joe Frazier out of the arena. He goes, that wouldn't look good. He goes, you know, Olympic gold medalist, world heavyweight champion, a renowned hero in Philadelphia. I just couldn't do it. He goes, you asked me to do like something. It was foreign to me. I just couldn't do it. Anyway, Joe Frazier, Muhammad Ali, good friends all the way until the end. Of course, they, you know, there was bad blood between them, but at the end, they were two old men. And when, before Joe went, Ali saw him. Ali was in tears. They hugged each other. And of course, Joe went, I think in 2012, from liver cancer. Could have had something to do with his drinking. Anyway, bottom line is Joe went. Ali was there. Ali was hurt. I remember talking to Ali about Joe Frazier in China one time, and he said to me, because, you know, Joe Frazier was the most mentally strong man I've ever seen in my life, and I think I have to agree with him, because of all the athletic events I've ever seen in my entire life, and I've been around a little bit, I've never seen anybody so determined, so physically, so mentally, like possessed. I mean, Joe Frazier, in that first fight in March of 1971, coming up on 50 years in a few weeks, of course, that was the most grit and determination I've ever seen in my life, because he wasn't all that talented of a guy. I mean, he wasn't super. He could punch, and he was in good shape. And you know what? He took a punch well. I mean, he ran into George Foreman, okay? But he took a punch well, and he and Ali engaged in probably one of the greatest fights of all time. Of course, getting rocked in the 12th round, Muhammad Ali almost went down in the 12th round. I thought it was over at that point in time. I'm listening on the radio. Ali's falling, ready to fall. Ali's falling. I'm going, oh, my God. Because, you know, you're listening on the radio, and you can't listen to live radio. Because what they do is they would tell you what the round was like after the round was over. In other words, it was news. So they would tell you what round two was about and after round three. Okay, stuff like that. Anyway, so Ali was all hurt in the 12th round. He's about to get knocked out. He's about to get knocked out. I'm saying to myself, oh, my God, I'm freaking out. Listen to this on the radio. So we come back, the 15th round. You know, it's still a reasonably close fight. I think Muhammad Ali might even be ahead, at least in my mind. Anyway, Larry Merchant thought so too at the time. But Joe Frazier knocked down the 15th round, sealed that win, no doubt about that. Of course, that was like the greatest hook of all time, and bah, boom, there's never been a greater hook. And Ali got up. He got up, and he was probably winning that round. He knew he had to come back and make good for himself after getting knocked down. I remember asking him about that knockdown. He told me the same thing I said about Ernie Chavez. You don't see them hooks, man. He only got knocked down by hooks. I mean, Sonny Banks knocked him down. Joe Frazier knocked him down. The Englishman knocked him down. I mean, Henry Cooper, all with hooks. Punches you don't see. That's what's so crazy about boxing. In other words, Hector Martinez told me he got knocked down once by a punch that he saw coming at him. I've never been knocked out by a punch I saw. Every punch that I get knocked down by, and I've been knocked down a few times, you didn't see him. And, of course, it's the ones you don't see that hurt the most. Anyway, Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier coming up on 50 years. I hope to have Marvis Frazier in next week. That was the plan this week, but Marvis got flaky and Richard Sloan didn't get him on paper. Bottom line is we'll try to get that going next week. Joe Frazier remembered to a greater extent next week with his son, Marvis Frazier. You are tuned to Ring Talk Live Worldwide. This time it's real. Lenny Williams and Tower of Power to the break.
I wish I might make you my all-star shining bright. I know I can feel it. This time is real.
Now more of Ring Talk with Pedro Fernandez.
My buddy Biggie. May he rest in peace. Biggie Smalls. You are tuned to Ring Talk Live Worldwide. You're inside looking to the world of boxing, MMA. You know, there's a little bit of hypocrisy probably in the show with myself today. Of course, I talked about, you know, white collar boxers. Now, some guys should never put on a boxing glove or wear a headgear or something like that. Some guys just aren't made for it, okay? But here I was in my 60s, okay? And I'm in good shape, real good physical shape. And I was contemplating maybe fighting in the 2021 National Golden Gloves, because I want 5 Golden Glove championships. I only got 4. So, I mean, there's a bit of hypocrisy if there ever was, huh? Bottom line is, boxing it's addictive, it's seductive, but most importantly, it's dangerous. And you gotta realize that before you get into it. This is not baseball. This is not, rowing a boat. This is not golf, anything like that. This is where people are trying to hurt you. This is a hurting business, a hurting game. And you'll find that out quick enough if you want to become a boxer, white collar or not. For those of you out there that contemplate maybe taking part in little, smokers and this and that, if you're 30 years old and you can't fight much, you never had a fight, if they give you another 30-year-old guy that's sort of like you, okay, a stockbroker type of guy, maybe fight him. Okay, but I don't think you should be fighting anybody with any experience at all. In other words, if you're a blue-collar, a white-collar guy, stick with white-collar guys. Fight guys from the IT department next door and stuff like that. Don't be taking on amateur boxers, because what happens when you come into the real world, you get hurt. And you get hurt in boxing, guess what? The residual effects are not kind. I can go on and on, but you can hear Muhammad Ali there. It was 1977, and you can hear the residual effects of professional boxing had already struck him. That was back in 77. So what I'm trying to tell you, even Ali got hurt. So at the end of the day, boxing's a great game. She taught me discipline. I mean, I don't think I'd be the person I am without it, okay? But then again, I didn't get hit that much, and that really means a lot, a lot. So think about that. If you take too many punches, maybe boxing ain't for you. You are tuned to Ring Talk Live Worldwide. Check it. 37, make that 38 plus years now. You're inside looking to the world of boxing and mixed martial arts. We are a production of the Sports Byline Broadcast Network. The executive producer and the man throwing all kinds of stuff around there in the other studios, Mr. Scott Cuddy. My name is Pedro Fernandez. And, of course, I want to thank you for tuning in to Ring Talk Live Worldwide. We are Saturday and Sundays at 11 a.m. Pacific time, live on Sports Byline. That's 2 p.m. Eastern time, live on sportsbyline.com, iHeartRadio, of course. Check out our channel. And, of course, we've got the Twitch video going on as well. Of course, the Sports Byline USA, twitch.tv video. Of course, the post-fight podcasts are always at anchor.fm and iTunes, all that kind of good stuff. Straight up, you are tuned to Ring Talk Live Worldwide, 38 years now of knocking out all bums. I am your modest host. My name is Pedro Fernandez. So next week, keep your hands up, keep your chin down, most importantly, keep your butt off the canvas of life.